This is the Improve Photography Podcast, episode number 145. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improve Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today you are joined by thousands and thousands of photographers from all around the world, all sitting down or sweating out on the treadmill. Some of us are commuting to work, but we're mentally sitting down to geek out and get our weekly dose of photography knowledge. We have tons of stuff coming at you today, talking about the business side of photography. We're also talking about the new light camera coming out, and we're also talking about some computers for post-processing in Jeff's Guide to Buying a Computer for Photo Editing. So welcome to the show, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Darren, I'm going to throw this one over to you first. And you're wanting to talk about the light camera. This one's definitely made the rounds on the internet this week. So, I mean, it looks crazy, but what is it to somebody who hasn't seen it yet?
Pretty much someone who hasn't seen it yet. It looks like an iPhone 6 Plus. It's a little bit thicker. It has 16 little slots on the back of it that are actually lenses. And
I was thinking more Nintendo DS.
I could see that, yeah. or a Game Boy or Sega. Sega, if you're a Sega loyalist. But it looks like one of those that has a 4 or 5 inch touchscreen on the back of it. And I'm wondering whether it's going to revolutionize digital photography, because we've had promises of that so many times in the past. Like, is it going to share a similar niche space like the lights of the Lytra Loom that's hovering at a similar price point? Or is this thing really going to dominate photography? Because the founders of this company carry around a 5D Mark III in their introductory video, and they're saying, well, I'm tired of carrying around this camera. It's so big. The lenses are so big and bulky. I want something where I can create equally as good of images as a high-end DSLR like this in a compact piece of hardware, and they think they've done it, but it is at a very high price point. It starts out at $1,299 now, and that's if you order it by November 6, 2015, but the price goes clear up to $1,699 thereafter, so that's getting pretty steep, and I think the expectations of what images would come out of a device like that at $1,699 should be pretty darn high, especially if you're looking just at a camera body at that price point from the DSLR makers and mirrorless camera makers that we have currently. There's not really too many details on the product beyond what light the manufacturer is actually providing via their press kit. I've read articles from the folks at Verge, Forbes, MIT, CNET, and everyone else you could possibly think of, and most of the reviews have photos of themselves holding a non-functional model of it with the screen turned off, a picture of the chassis, and a 3D print of the camera's folded lens configuration. And what I mean by folded lens is that the light comes in these aperture openings. Like I said, there's 16, 17 if you count the infrared sensor on the back of the camera openings in there, and that's what they call the aperture, which is the opening in there. It's reflected off of a mirror, and based on the focal length, it's translated via the lens elements, and it gives you a focal length effective of 30 millimeters, or 35 millimeters, 70 millimeters, and 150 millimeters, and then it's
so,
all.
So make sure I understand this. Yep. So when I look at the back of the camera, I see a whole bunch of lenses. Got 16 lenses on there.
Yep.
But we also have 16 imaging sensors on there, right? Is that correct?
Yep, 16 imaging sensors that are 13 megapixels each. So that's on par with the iPhone 6S models that just were released here in September.
Okay, so it's taking pictures with 16, like, looks like cell phone size kind of cameras. So
correct.
16 of these cameras, 16 cell phone cameras on the back of this device, and they're all at different focal lengths. And what's that supposed to do for us?
It's supposed to give you unlimited depth of field and create a really high megapixel image for something like this. So it shoots 10 of them at once with every shot simultaneously, and then uses computational algorithms to give you up to a 52 megapixel image. And they're kind of playing off of what Lytra did with the Illum, to where you can have depth of field control afterwards, but it's not using the same technology. So you can have that look of f1.2, which is what they're touting as their max aperture, but instead of using light field technology, they're just using an algorithm that is Gaussian blur to kind of make it look like what your lenses would do if you actually truly had an f1.2 wide open aperture capability.
Okay, so let's do this. I think all of us see some potential here, right? Like, if you had this camera, this futuristic, amazing little wizard box that could do this with a bunch of different sensors and with an algorithm, we could give unlimited depth of field, and we can change the depth of field to wherever we want it to be. We get whatever things that we can do with this cool octopus looking camera.
Yep.
How many years? The question is this. We're gonna do a poll all at once. I want everybody to plunk down your answer. How many years do you think it will be before this technology comes down far enough that you'd be willing to plunk down $1,600? All right. Everybody think of how many years you think it's gonna be until this is a viable technology. 3, 2, 1.
10.
5.
I say 10.
I didn't hear an answer from Jeff, so that's like I infinity. Said
5. Yeah. 5.
But they are going to produce it. I mean, they're really excited about it. They possibly have some group thing going on within the company Lipe. They definitely have the company Foxconn, which is best known for making Apple's iPhones, on board. They've invested $25 million.
Yeah, they're just licking their chops because it's like, wait, we can only sell one cell phone camera per device to Apple. We get to sell 16 to these guys. We're in.
Exactly. Exactly. But, I mean, it seems like it's just going to be a niche thing. I mean, all this information out there, it seems all nice. It's all pie in the sky. But I don't really think that a camera that's using an algorithm to give you Gaussian blur, to which you can do inside Photoshop really easily just by creating a new layer, is something worth $1,600. I'd rather put my money elsewhere. I mean, my initial thoughts is it's probably going to be a flop because consumers aren't really going to want to put that much money into it. And then a pro who has a lot of demands and is possibly using a full frame or mirrorless or DSLR camera doesn't want to look at the image that this is producing with low light. If you even look at their sample images where they're touting it as great low light capabilities, I would say that, you know, the new LG G4 has better low light capabilities just from my observations than what this thing is producing.
So here's the place where I think it's going to have a struggle. As you're using a good zoom lens, I don't know, maybe it's because we're trained this way or because this is how it works, but you have your off hand on the lens doing the zoom in and out. And then you have your fingers, the other hand, doing the buttons, the shutter, other settings, whatever it is. And when you get to know your camera really well, you don't even have to take your eye out of the viewfinder. You can just fire away, change stuff really, really fast. I don't see how you can do that with this thing.
No, you're going to be searching through menus. You're going to be looking at the back of a large LCD screen because this doesn't even have a viewfinder besides the LCD screen. It's like a mirror system without an OLED.
They talk about a capacitive touch thing towards the upper right hand side of the device so that you can change the zoom in and out. But even at that, I mean, okay, hold on, Mr. Person I'm taking an action shot of. I gotta hurry and do my capacitive touch zoom to the right level so that I can get the right composition as you're doing your cool thing. That it's just, even if the camera sensors and all the stuff they've got going on in there can take something fast enough to make a really high resolution good shot of that, I just don't see how the controls are going to be responsive enough. The design of how stuff works just feels to me like it's not going to be successful.
Yeah, you know what I'd be a lot more excited about in a camera is we've been talking about ISO invariance on the podcast and how on some cameras, you really don't even need to set the ISO anymore because it looks just as good, the same amount of noise, by just increasing the exposure in Photoshop as it and shooting underexposed as it does if you set it high, which gives you the ability to just set it later so you can get it to the perfect amount. That's pretty cool. And then what if we could do the same thing with the shutter speed? Like what if we could have a camera that would record what the exposure looks like every couple milliseconds over a 3-second period, and then we can set the ISO later, and we can set the shutter speed later. I mean, that's really, really incredible. That's the kind of thing that I would be really excited to buy. I think this is a long ways off, but seriously cool looking camera. Great job marketing. The fact that we haven't seen a working version yet and they're going to release this sucker in 6 months, it's a little bit scary.
I'd be scared to be on the pre-order list, but it might have some potential down the road, but maybe if they go belly up and Lytro goes belly up, maybe they can create that camera that you're talking about, the Magic Box.
Yeah, well, see, the first time I saw Lytro, and I know this is totally different, but the first time I saw Lytro was at a photo walk, and somebody was showing it off, and everybody, you know, crowded around him. Oh, that's so cool. And then about 6 months later, I was at another photo walk, and somebody brought one out of their bag, and somebody said, oh, yeah, I have one of those hanging up on my tree as a Christmas ornament.
But I do like that there's someone thinking outside the box, trying to do something different and pushing the tech. That's going to be good for all of us.
Great story, Darren. Thanks for sharing that with us. Jeff, what do you got for us this week? I know you've been working on this for a long time.
Yeah. So what I have, I'm going to just do a really brief summary of it. What's going to come is this coming Monday on October 19th, I'm going to have an article published at improvephotography.com that has an expert guide, or the ultimate guide, I guess I want to say, to buying a new Windows PC for photo editing. So over the past probably month, I've been getting a lot of questions, a lot of feedback about questions. It's been questions. Listeners, readers have been saying, I'm in the market now. I'm finally tired of all the slowness with Lightroom, which may be just due to Lightroom. But I'm tired of waiting so much on my computer. I've decided it's time to get a new one. What should I get? And so, Nick, you've recently gone through this. Tell me what your experience has been as you go to look up the options.
Well, there's all kinds of options. I work off a desktop, and I've been thinking lately that how handy would it be to actually have a laptop that was powerful enough to do photo and video editing? And when you go out to do it, you know, you have, should I get a Windows 10 machine? Should I get a Windows 7 machine? Because I know I don't want a Windows 8 machine. And and there's so many different options as far as, like, by the time you really get it all spec'd out and you have your solid state drive and you know, all the RAM you need and you get the right video card in it, like, the price just jumps through the roof. So, I'm constantly trying to shop for everything that I want with the specs that I want, and then try to keep it under $2,000. And it's kind of tricky,
right? And well, there's so much so many options too. You have all the different makers: Dell, HP, Lenovo, Asus, Acer, just to name a few of the top ones. Who do you buy from? And it depends on who you ask about, like, the customer service experience or the shopping experience overall. And they leapfrog each other too. I've had some horrible experiences with some, and then later on they have the right deal. I try it again and it's a better experience, and it changes. It's not the same. Plus, when you finally decide, okay, I'm going to try this particular vendor of a PC, you go to configure it, and for a lot of photographers, I have to imagine that the specs that you have to choose from make absolutely no sense. Mm-hmm. You don't know what to pick. You don't know what's important for photography editing, which is fairly demanding. Not nearly as demanding as video editing. That's a whole different level, but it's fairly demanding. If you are a user of a PC that's only going to do web browsing, you can get almost any old thing and be okay. But if you're going to try to do photo editing, there's some stuff you really have to have, or it's going to be awful.
Yeah.
And so that's what my guide's got going to have on Monday. I've spent, it's actually at this point now better than 30 hours researching all the different options out there of all the different PC makers, what they present in their configuration options. And I have a guide that's going to walk through what the options mean, which ones are important for photo editing, then even like the top models that are out there. And I'm going to tell you which ones I think you should get.
So it's better than just going out and buying a spec'd out computer, because, I mean, back when I was a big gaming nerd, I would just go out and buy an Alienware, this or that, with this and, much RAM and this video card, etc.
And that would absolutely work. You would be happy. If you went and bought some top-of-the-line gaming machine, that's going to work. That's going to be great. But you're going to have overspent on the stuff. You can be happy doing photo editing without going all the way there. So just to give a really brief summary in the podcast, and you're going to want to go check out the article on Monday. But here's the order I would prioritize things when you're going to buy a computer for photo editing. I think the number one thing to get right now is an SSD drive in your computer. Absolutely. I've had lots of experience tearing into machines. I've really tested this out. And that is the thing that makes the most difference in doing photo editing.
I can't agree more. Like, since
it is huge.
Since I took your advice and got a solid state drive for my working drive, everything is so much faster. I was complaining really hard about Lightroom before, and then it was like, maybe it's not so bad once I got my solid state drive. So yeah, totally agree. having a good solid state drive speeds everything up.
You could hear the conviction in Nick's voice when he was talking about his solid state drive and how much he loved it on the Portrait Session podcast. Uh-huh. He's like, I just love this thing.
Okay, the next most important thing then is memory.
Wait, can I jump in on one thing on that?
Okay.
Most computers have the solid spinning drive. So if you're not as techie, this is the old school way that a drive used to be. Your computer probably has a spinning regular hard drive if it's more than 2 years old. I mean, a lot of computers even more than 2 years ago had solid state. But if you don't know what it is and your computer's 2 years old, good chance you have a regular spinning hard drive. And so a solid state drive is it's the best way that you can breathe new life Absolutely. Into your computer. So this isn't just about, when you're buying a new computer. This is also like if your computer's just really slow right now, but you don't want to buy a whole new computer, it's still got a lot of life in it, go buy an SSD. It's going to cost you, $200 to get an SSD?
If that, yep. I've been pushing out a lot of, if you're in our Facebook groups, I post deals out there on them because they go on sale a lot. And you can catch them on a deal for a lot less than that.
And then the trick you need, if you've never done this before, is you're also going to want to buy on Amazon. I think this is the easiest way to get this done. If you only have one drive in your computer, you need to get Windows from your current drive to this new SSD. So you'll just buy, they have little kits. We'll link to it in the show notes. A little kit that'll have like an eSATA drive or connection that you hook to the, or from USB in your computer to the eSATA on the new SSD, and you literally just copy it over. It'll have software that comes with it. It'll copy everything from your current current configuration over to the new drive. Then you turn the computer off, slip in the new drive, and you're gold, ready to go.
Yep.
So this is really helpful, the information you're sharing for new computers, also for existing computers.
It's one of the advantages of PC overall. This is the type of thing that you can do. It may sound scary to a lot of photographers, but it's not really that hard to do it. And actually, I'm sure you can even find someone to help you with it if you ask around.
I guarantee there's a geek in your life who's just going to feel like he won the lottery when he gets to take apart somebody's
computer.
You're
willing to pay him $50 to do it for you, and it will be worth it. Next thing on the priority list would be RAM. I've done some pretty serious testing now using lots of different machines. Lightroom wants at least 1 gig of RAM when it starts up. So does Photoshop. Your browser also pretty well wants 1 gig of RAM when it starts up. So just running those three applications and nothing else on your computer, you have 3 gigs of RAM that it wants. You need to give Windows 2 gigs of RAM to run the operating system. So that gives you up to 5. That's not without even doing anything in these tools. That's just starting them. Then when you run them, so I've done some tests where in Lightroom, I just scrolled through 300 pictures. It wasn't anything. I wasn't doing sliders. I wasn't changing anything. I just next, scrolling through. It jumped up to needing 2 more gigs of RAM, bringing a total to 3 there. And in Photoshop, I did 1 HDR merge of 7 photos, and it jumped up to needing 4. The bottom line is you need at least to run all those applications at once, Photoshop, Lightroom, and a browser, you need, and Windows, 9 gigs of RAM. So those machines where you have 8, it's going to start running out of RAM if you're running those things all together. So my recommendation is getting 16 gigs of RAM when you buy your computer, although 8 will be probably okay as long as you have an SSD. The price you pay for it running out of RAM is much better than if you don't.
So for the uninitiated, what is RAM going to do for you, like in a practical sense? How's that going to feel on the computer other than just like faster?
Yeah. So RAM is going to be very heavily utilized as you are manipulating the images. There's the two things it's the next thing on the list too. The CPU is the next thing on the list, but RAM is very heavily used to take what the image is off of the drive. So we had that SSD. It's going to read that up and put it into RAM, which is significantly faster than even that SSD drive is. And then as you are doing your edits on it, it's working off that in the memory instead of off of anything on the drive. And so the more you have where it can cache those, and Lightroom will try to do a good job of caching like a few images behind the one you're working on. It'll try to fetch stuff up so that things can be faster. That's where it's going to pay off. If you have, let's say, 4 gig of RAM and it doesn't have enough to pull those images up into the memory, it means it has to go ask the hard drive. In this case, the SSD is what we're recommending. It has to ask the hard drive for that stuff a lot more, and that slows things down considerably.
And I have to ask the king of nerd this question, because it was a big deal at least a while ago when I was looking at computers before I went to Mac. Does it matter these days that with all these different types of RAM, like DDR3, the how many megahertz the RAM is or gigahertz the RAM is?
So you're going to be pretty much locked into what the computer supports. It's okay. Going to depend on what you've bought. It's only going to support one kind. You don't have a choice. So,
and that's controlled by the motherboard, yeah, is that right?
That's right.
So it's not, you can't alter that.
Right. You're not going to be able to take, sometimes if you've got a little bit older computer, you might be able to upgrade it, but you're going to need to find out what kind of RAM goes in it, because it changes from architecture, you know, from year to year, it changes, and it's not backwards compatible. You can't take brand new, state-of-the-art, best speed memory and stick it in any old motherboard. Okay, so next on the list is CPU. It's all the way down to third, which is kind of amazing to me that that's where we're at. but for photo editing in particular, it's not another use case. It's just for photo editing. I do think that it is only the third most important thing. Those other two are more important, and it's worth spending money on those other two things before spending money on this. So the best is the Core i7 processors. That's the best price to performance kind of thing that you can get. The Core i5 is probably going to be fine too, though. It's just, you know, it would be worth upgrading between the i5 and the i7 if you've got the budget for it. But I would say, again, SSD and memory would be more important to spend money on than going from i5 to i7 for the CPU.
I totally agree there. I have to. You know this a lot more about this than I do. But I will also say that I've tried editing video on an i5 computer with everything else was great. Even had an SSD, but it was an i5, and it just couldn't do 1080p.
Video is a whole different thing. Do it. Yep. You have to have the i7, maybe even all the way to Xeon for video editing. It's just going to be really tough.
And I'll slip in there that I edit 1080p video. I do everything in 1080p. And the newest version of the MacBook Air, if you completely spec it out with everything that you can, it barely will squeak by about a 7-minute 1080p video. If longer than 7 minutes, and it starts to cough its way to death, but it'll barely do it.
In my guide,
if you're on most video I do on my iMac, and it just cruises through video, no problem at all.
Another note on the CPU, the mobile version of CPUs is not the same as the desktop version of CPUs. They are designed to be energy efficient, and you won't get nearly the processing power out of them. So there's, unfortunately, that's just the way it is, and you're not going to have a choice. So like you said, Jim, that accounts for some of it too. It's not only the difference in Core i7 versus i5, but the mobile version versus the desktop version in the iMac is a big reason for that difference. Okay, next most important. These are now a lot less important. Those first three things, if you can get that, you're going to be pretty good. But the next thing I wanted to point out was either a Thunderbolt port or a USB 3.0 port on the machine. And this isn't really something to worry that much about. Any computer you go to buy right now is going to have at least a USB 3.0 port. The good thing is, as I've done some research, even though Thunderbolt hasn't really been on many PCs in the past, there's a few now that do. As I went and spec'd out these machines out on the different PC websites, there's a number of them that have Thunderbolt, and not only just Thunderbolt, but Thunderbolt 3, which is more advanced than a lot of any of the Macs have right now. So that's a really cool thing, something that you can look for and get. And the reason this is important would be, going back to the first choice of the SSD drive, you're going to have a pretty small drive there. Probably going to be about 256 gig, maybe 512 gig is probably where you're going to end up. And you're not going to be able to store all that many photos in that kind of space. So you have to have external storage available. And in order to connect that in a really fast connection, you need either Thunderbolt or USB 3. Anything else is going to be too slow, and you're really going to feel it as you're editing your photos.
Yeah. I learned about the PCs having Thunderbolt the hard way a couple weeks ago when we were talking on the podcast and I mentioned that Thunderbolt was a Mac thing. Man, did the hate mail flow in. So that's how I learned about PCs having Thunderbolt.
The funny thing is, Thunderbolt has always been an Intel thing. They are the ones who created it. It just happens that Apple put them in their computers. So everyone thinks it's an Apple technology. It's Intel. So
yeah, don't you have a Photo Taco that discusses that as well?
Yeah, talk about the USB-C ports and the Thunderbolt ports and the speeds and stuff like that. So if you want to hear more about that, go find the Photo Taco on it. Okay, the last thing I wanted to mention, and then we'll move on, is for connecting an external display, you've got different technologies that can do that. You have the way old VGA, and that's the one that you absolutely do not want. Then you have HDMI, which is probably pretty sufficient for a lot of cases. But boy, the higher resolution monitors that we've been talking about and recommending, HDMI will struggle to provide enough bandwidth to drive those monitors. You can't get enough resolution out of them over HDMI. You can but it's really pushing it. And same with even DVI. With 4K displays, 5K displays, you're reaching the limits of what even DVI can do, which has been the high-end standard for a while. So the answer is DisplayPort. That's what the Macs have in them too. The Thunderbolt connections are actually doing DisplayPort out to a monitor. And most PCs for a couple years now have been coming pretty standard with a DisplayPort connection as well. And that is the one that can drive these monitors the best. The highest resolution. We're not pushing the limits of it with a DisplayPort like you are with all the other technologies. So that's an important thing to look for.
I'm excited for this article. This is going to be awesome.
There's the summary.
Yeah, that's great.
I go through a whole bunch more detail in the article on each one of these, why it's important, what to spend money on, what not to spend money on, and recommendations on specific models as of now.
So one last thing that I kind of want everybody's input on just really quick is what would you say is the resolution of a computer that you say, hey, this is fine. As soon as you get to this resolution, I'm totally happy editing photos. Jeff, what do you say?
I'd say the 2560, the WQXGA.
So that's 2560 by 1440 pixels. Yes,
and it's just below 4K. You know, it's kind of in between HD and 4K.
For a laptop or for a desktop?
No, for
or
a
both?
Desktop. On a laptop with a 15-inch or 13-inch screen, I don't see how you're going to tell a whole lot of difference between HD and other better resolutions.
Yeah, I agree. I think 1080 is pretty good on a laptop. Cool if you can get more. Tell the difference, but
there's a good reason to have a lower resolution on the laptop. The more pixels it has to push, the more battery it takes to do that. So,
good point.
So 1080, if battery's important, some of these things you don't want to go up the max. You want to limit it so that you can get more battery life.
Good. Darren, what do you say?
I had to look up on my computer to find out what I'm running. Mine's pre-5K iMac, 27-inch, and I'm doing the 2560 and completely satisfied with it. So, loving it.
Cool. And Nick, what are you, using?
Whoever that quiet guy is over there.
You guy.
You forgot I was here, right?
I was hoping you'd left, but left by now.
So, I'm on a 27-inch monitor on my desktop, and it looks like I'm only actually running 1920 by 1080. So that actually surprises me because it seems like that would have looked low resolution, but I don't notice it. My resolution seems fine. And
you still create awesome photos.
Yeah.
You're connected HDMI, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I'm DVI. Interesting.
You should see if you can bump that up.
I was just looking. Like, I was trying to cram for the test. Like, it was like, oh God, they're going to ask me something. So I looked really quick, and it's set as high as it'll go.
I was shocked at how big a difference that made when I went from 1080 all the way up to that next level.
Interesting.
It was amazing to me. I don't think that jump from there to like 4K is nearly as big.
And not even close.
And the only reason it's not right now, I think, is because the software doesn't support, like the Windows OS, the Mac OS, the Adobe products, they don't really support that next resolution up very well today. It's going to change, and it's going to become more important in the future, I think.
Yeah, so I've been using the iMac 5K for almost a year now, and like my eyes are just totally used to it. I would love to set up a 2560 by 1440 now and just see kind of what I would think of it after I've had this long to use it. But I will say, looking side by side, 2560 by 1440 compared to 5K, we're talking about a minor, tiny, tiny difference. And anybody who says otherwise has not really seen them side by side.
Yep.
This is a small difference. Text looks a tiny bit sharper. And if you really look for it, you can see that little bit of extra sharpness in photos and stuff. But it's not a big difference. It's just not at the 27-inch size. You know, when you look at a 4K TV, holy cow, huge difference because it's big. You can tell the difference. But on a 27-inch screen, it's just not a big deal. I would have no problem going to the previous generation iMac. You're just not missing out on much. But I love the screen. I mean, I love having the latest and greatest. I'm just saying, if you can save some money and get the previous generation, just do it and don't even think twice about it.
And that's really the goal of my guide here. I'm trying to say, here's what's going to make you have a good experience at the best possible price.
Very good. Thanks for doing that, Jeff. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the business side of photography. I've got to apologize right up front that some of this information is just United States centric. I hate it when I do that. I always try to be really careful to talk about topics and talk about measurements and things in terms that people outside of the United States understand. A large portion of our audience is outside the United States. But I did just want to mention that on improvephotography.com, I published an article called The Simple Guide to Setting Up a Photography Business Legally. And it's a huge, long post. It really does go through everything you need. I said in the start of the post, I have $20,000 worth of tax mistakes in that post. And so if you are any amount of money with your photography, please, you know, set aside a little bit of time and read that. I also want to mention that I have my photography contracts. I am an attorney and I'm a photographer, obviously. And so I have my own contracts that I've been using for years for everything. I have a real estate photography contract in there, a wedding photography contract, a contract you'd need if you hire a second shooter, a contract that a nature or fine art photographer would use if you're selling a photo, or a portrait photographer who licenses a photo to a company, a general photography contract for, you know, babies, senior portraits, whatever. Just tons of contracts in there. And as an attorney, a normal price would be to sell a contract at $250. And I'm giving you all of them for just $10. I want you to have your contracts. And so I've put a lot of work into polishing them up, putting in some of the latest things in there. Man, you can create a huge headache if you don't have everything in writing with your clients. And so please do yourself a favor and just at least go check it out. It's only $10 because I really want everybody to be able to have them. Just be sure you have them. And I even made the general photography contract free just so that I just don't want you to do this without having it in writing. I mean, it can be a life-altering mistake if you do something like that wrong. And it just doesn't need to be. You don't need to be scared of the business of photography. And that's what this is all about. I'm trying to just walk you through the basics so that you don't feel intimidated by it and you feel confident that you can make money with your photography if that's what you want. So check that out.
Question for you, Jim. As a hobbyist, I don't do a whole lot of portrait shoots or paid shoots from anybody. I've never done a contract with anybody. How would you approach that? Usually it's like, you know, pretty close friends that I'm doing it for, or maybe there's a word of mouth where it's a friend of a friend at the most, not a total stranger to me. How would you approach that?
You know, my thought, seeing the nasty side of the legal system, a contract is not something that you have to feel rude by asking somebody to sign. A contract is really the nicest thing you can do for your client because it's going to spell out any chance of there being any hard feelings in any way about the deal. That's really the whole purpose of it. And so I don't have any problem asking even a close friend, hey, will you please sign this model release? Why? It's not that I think they're going to sue me if I use their photo. Even, you know, I would ask their permission. And right. if they say yes, you know, I would trust my friend. But it's that I really want to make sure that we're clear and that I don't have any hard feelings developed between you. Business and friends is always tough. And so I think that's a situation where you especially need a contract just so that you can have the opportunity to sit down with them and say, hey, I'm planning to put this on my website to advertise my business. Is that okay with you? And then they'll know exactly what you're going to do so that you would never have any hard feelings between you.
Okay.
And that's all I have to say about that.
I was waiting for Nick. I'm like, I want Nick to say something, please. Well, he's probably working over
what
there.
What other follow-up thing then? At what point would you present it to him then, Jim? Is it like when you're showing up to do the shoot or like email it to him and say, hey, would you bring a signed copy with you? Or how would you, when do you present it?
I would do it as soon as you take money for it, and I always take a down not a deposit. It has to be an initial payment, and I talk about that in there. But whenever they pay the first time, that's when I'm having them sign a contract. If it's for a wedding, I'm gonna want to do this way in advance.
Yeah.
Why? Because weddings break up all the time, and I want to make sure that this is in place a long time before the bride and groom call it quits. So that's when I do it. If it's just, you know, I'm shooting a senior portrait, see, one thing that I like about the way that I made the contracts is I have a short form general contract that's like, you know, this is a friend. I just want to quick spell out a couple things. One pager, quick sign here. Done, right? And then
but
a longer
when would you
form,
show it to them?
I would probably just show it to them as soon as they pay. If you have them pay before, then do it then. Otherwise, the morning of. It's short enough that it's not like, here's 40 pages, sign this sucker, and it's going to be like, oh, that's kind of unfair. You just sprung this on me, you know? So I like that there is that short form contract in there for kind of that situation that you're talking about, Jeff, that like, yeah, you know, I don't want to offend anybody or like spring this huge legal document on them. I just want to be clear between us, and that's perfect. That's what it's for.
Right.
Oh, and also I have a model release in there. Always get the model release. Street photographers are the worst about this because they always say, no, it messes up the subject, man. No, take your picture, have the decency to walk up to somebody, be a man, be a woman, walk up to them and say, hey, I took a photo of you. It's beautiful. I want to share it with you. Would you please sign this model release? If you don't have the decency to do that, you probably shouldn't be taking the picture. I hate it when street photographers hide behind this artsy fartsy thing. No, I can't talk to them. I just take their photo and leave. And then they go out and they do something that I think is pretty unfair to the person. They go and sell the photo. They use it to advertise their services without the person's permission. Guess what? That's not okay. And it is illegal, depending on, you know, some circumstances. There are some exceptions to that. And so have the decency. Have a model release that's short, simple, and you can give to people so that you're clear with everybody you shoot.
And would
all
that
right,
be
off the soapbox?
Well, one question real quick. So since I do street photography and everyone knows that, should I possibly just use the app on my phone that has a model release built in there, or should I have a printed one for ease for them to have a copy? What would you do in that situation? Because I do want to take the ethical high ground in that and not hide behind the artsy fartsy thing. So what would you suggest?
Well, I think the apps on the phone are fine. I'm not really concerned about that. The problem that I have with the apps on the phone, and there could be one that does this well, if there is, please let me know because I'd love to use it, is they're too in-depth. I mean, they're asking the people, like, take a selfie of yourself to prove you were here, and what's your date of birth and race and your address and everything. A model release can be that complicated, and in certain circumstances, like if I were shooting stock photography, it should be that complicated, you know, because there that image could go anywhere. But if this is just a simple model release, like, hey, I'm just doing a street photography, that was a sweet photo of you, I just want to be clear, is it all right with you if I use the photo? Then just a short, simple model release. I haven't found one that I like the contract and the simplicity of it on the phone. And so I have that paper one that I like just for the simplicity. But if there is one on the phone, I have no problem with using an app. I mean, I would love to find a short one, but I haven't found one that I like the contract.
Very cool. Well, maybe we can design one one day.
Yeah. All right. Well, in each episode, we want to share a doodad of the week. And we have some pretty cool ones for you guys this week. Nick, what do you got?
So I bought a new ball head this week. I went to a photography conference and I let people sell me things. Yeah, it was a weak moment. And as soon as I held this beautiful ball head in my hands, I had to have it. So I got, I know I'm going to butcher the pronunciation because it's not phonetic at all. Is it Siray? Is that right?
Siray.
So say that again?
Siray.
Okay.
Siray.
It's not how it's spelled at all. That's
like
just
someone
stupid.
With
it's
a
not.
Bad accent saying Siri.
If they,
yeah,
if they
it's
wanted
spelled it, Sarui.
If they wanted it pronounced that way, they should have put an A in it. But anyways, yeah. So the ball head itself, regardless of the stupid name, it's really functional, and I really like it. Before this one, I had the Enduro BHD2, I believe it was. It was like the one that's rated for around 40 pounds. And it was fine, but this ball head has kind of the tensioner knob is kind of hydraulic. It's got a nice fluid feel to it. And it's rated for 66 or how many pounds? It's like 70, what is it? It's 77
pounds.
They make
up that number anyway.
77.2 pounds it's rated for. And I know that the ratings aren't the most accurate thing in the world. It's just marketing speech. But it is super crazy solid. So really like this ball head. If you're in the market for one, check it out. It's the Sarui, whatever. It's the Sarui ball head. And I like mine.
Cool. Darren, what do you have?
Mine is a app for iPhone. I couldn't find it on the Android market prior to us recording, but it's the Easy Watermark Light. And for those of us who have cameras that have great connectivity where you can download your JPEG to your iPhone and want to share it right away on social media, there's this app called Easy Watermark Light. I'm not sure why you'd want to pay the $299 for the other one. I researched it. There's a couple extra bells and whistles, but if you just want to get a photo on the internet really quickly because you're pressed for time and it's a time-sensitive photo, download it from your camera onto your phone and download Easy Watermark so someone knows to go to your website and check out other work that you do.
Good stuff. Jeff?
Okay, so for me, I'm going to tell you about a Kickstarter I backed that actually did something, which is shocking. They don't,
all right.
It's called GeckoPod. And I'm loving it with my phone. So I've used some of those, like the Joby, is that what it's called? The spidery ones that look like they're
like
made of Legos, kind of.
Yeah.
And they're okay. They do a decent job, but this one it's more like Gumby. It's more malleable, it's more movable, and you can really wrap the sucker like around a tree branch, and it's just super useful. I've been really, really loving it. It's only $20, so not too expensive. It came with a smartphone attachment, so it has the normal tripod ball or tripod screw on it, and then you attach this little smartphone adapter thing, and my iPhone 6 Plus fits in it just fine. And so I'm loving it. It's cool.
Very good. And this week I want to share the Manfrotto 24-foot tall light stand.
Whoa.
See, there I go again with the American measurements and stuff. So 24 feet is 7.3 meters. This is a huge light stand, right? Like,
but
humongous. But why is this? There are several use cases for a very high angle. For example, when you're taking photos of real estate, I'm all excited right now. I'm trying to hide it here, but I'm not doing it well. We've been trying to sell our house, and I just got an offer on the house while we were podcasting, right?
Very all right. Cool.
We're moving to Meridian, baby. So when you're taking pictures of real estate, you want that high angle. Or this weekend, my brother was at a local football game, and the local news station had a camera on a 24-foot pole, so they get that high angle so you can actually see what's going on in the sports game.
Yeah.
So you can sometimes do this with a drone, which is a lot more expensive and adds a lot more complexity, but you would certainly wouldn't want to do that at a sporting event where there's so many people around. And sometimes you just you want that high angle, and so you can get this extremely tall light stand. You'll probably want to hold it and sandbag it down, but you can get a very high perspective for shooting where a drone doesn't work or where you just don't want the complexity of a drone. This is a really cool option and much less expensive. So Manfrotto 24-foot tall light stand looks pretty cool. If you are doing this professionally, by the way, the local news station was using something called endzonecamera.com. It's a $5,000 package, but it has a motorized head while you're videoing and stuff. It's pretty cool. So if that kind of fits your situation, then definitely check that out as well. That does it for this week on the Improved Photography Podcast. I really appreciate your support of Improved Photography and everything that you guys do for us. Love chatting with you guys through the week on the Facebook group, and all of you have been commenting on the website. I've been writing every single day on the website, new topics, and so I really enjoy chatting with everybody during the week. So check us out at improvephotography.com, and be sure to pick up all the other podcasts we do on the Improved Photography Network. You're just listening to the tip of the iceberg here. We have Photo Taco, which is a short 7-minute photo tip twice a week. You're also missing out on Portrait Session with Miss K and Erica and Nick. Miss K and Nick and Darren. They're the same people. Sheesh. Also, Thoughts on Photography with Brian McGuckin, which is a deep, in-depth interview that Brian does every week. He's doing a series on learning photography right now, which is being really interesting. So check them all out, or you can just go to improvephotography.com/podcasts, and you'll see all the shows right there. You can subscribe in iTunes. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll see you in another 7 days.